comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After days of pause in Yemen's naval operations, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea with multiple missiles. He said that the attack followed the drone and missile strikes against U.S. warships in the Red Sea.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces launched an attack on the Israeli ship MSC Sky sailing in the Arabian Sea with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The missiles hit the vessel in an accurate and direct manner. The operation came only hours after Yemen's armed forces targeted a number of enemy American warships in the Red Sea with a number of ballistic missiles and drones.
Experts say this operation sends a message to the US and UK that Yemen's armed forces are still capable of targeting Israeli-bound vessels in the regional waters. Despite their aggression against Yemen, they believe that the Yemeni army has not used its new weapons yet, which will be another challenge for the Western powers.
Yesterday's operations and the targeting of the Israeli ship and the American warships is a message that the Yemeni armed forces will continue their operations against the enemy. No matter what the Americans do, whether political or military moves, we will continue with our strategic options until the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. The Yemeni army will carry out more strikes and steal has big surprises for the enemy in the coming days, unless the enemy stops the brutal aggression against Gaza.
On Saturday, the British cargo ship Ruby Mar, which had been targeted by the Yemeni army last month, sank in the Red Sea. The sinking of the Ruby Mar has raised concerns about the potential ecological damage to the Red Sea and its coral reefs, as it was carrying more than 41 tons of fertilizer and had leaked oil for several days after the attack.
Yemeni officials hold the US and UK fully responsible for any pollution resulting from the sinking of the British ship. They assert that Washington is the one militarizing the Red Sea, supporting the Israeli war on Gaza and depriving Palestinians of humanitarian aid, which are the main reasons for Yemeni naval operations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The right to speak out, to protest, the very fabric of democratic rights, once again under attack in the UK, as the government updates its definition of extremism and is about to introduce a potential ban on parliamentarians joining protests. Recommendations from the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, also known as Lord Walney, who is a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, call on leaders of the mainstream political parties to instruct their MPs to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop, quote, hate on marches. In the crosshairs, climate activist groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who have organized the enormous peaceful mobilizations for Gaza since October last year.
This is an affront to democracy and an indication of a weak and decaying government's descent into authoritarianism. It's totally out of touch with the British people and actually very much out of keeping with the British values that they claim to champion.
Ahead of Walney's recommendations and after the by-election in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, that handed pro-Palestine campaigner George Galloway a thumping victory, a speech by the Prime Minister vilifying the pro-Palestinian protests demanding a ceasefire in Gaza.
In recent weeks and months, we have seen a shocking increase in extremist disruption and criminality. What started as protests on our streets has descended into intimidation, threats, and planned acts of violence.
Critics say comments like those about peaceful demonstrations are a threat to the long tradition of freedom of protest and expression in the country.
His assertions are totally false. I mean, you know, the claims of an increase in anti-Semitism, of extremism, there is no evidence for that. I mean, this is just pure invention and another indication, frankly, of how weak this government really is. To have a special address to the nation as if there was some sort of state of emergency. Some people that spoke to me thought that we'd declared war on Russia. What it was George Galloway, the leader of the Workers' Party, getting elected as a Member of Parliament. I mean, that should be celebrated, not attacked in that way. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
The new changes are yet to be announced and legislated, but the political temperature is rapidly rising in the UK.
In its 2024 World Report, Human Rights Watch says that the UK government's practices and policies have severely curtailed domestic human rights protections. Others say the country is at risk of turning into a police state masquerading as a democracy. The question now is, how deep will those erosions go? And will the MPs in the building behind me allow them to continue? Saeed Purizap, London.
Iran has held a final round of a national moot court to stimulate taking proceedings against enforcers of unilateral sanctions and those who comply with them. The session was held by Iran's Institute of Judiciary in cooperation with the country's High Council for Human Rights in Tehran. Speaking at the event, the secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that sanctions were considered weapons of war and even more destructive than a war due to their substantial impacts and being a collective punishment against a targeted country's people.
Undeniable rights cannot be ignored in sanctions, and implementing global peace and security cannot be possible without taking such rights into consideration. The legality of the legitimacy of sanctions is an important issue that the Security Council must consider in the discussion of imposing sanctions. Meanwhile, the international community has not yet accepted the legitimacy of unilateral sanctions.
Elena Duhan, UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, also delivered a speech at the session via video conference.
In the situation of Iran, the most absurd cases refer to the impossibility to deliver bandages for EB patients from the only monopolist producer in Sweden, and similarly impossibility to deliver the medicine necessary for thalassemia patients suffering from some sort of autist state, as well as some sort of psychological and physical diseases, especially if we are talking about the rare ones or the most severe ones. As a result, these are patients which are not directly designated by any type of sanctions, which are deprived of any possibility of access to health care system.
Meanwhile, speaking at the session, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani said sanctions were the biggest crimes against humanity and were a collective punishment and proof that those who pursue and promote unilateralism do not respect human rights.
Iran is among the countries under the U.S. cruel sanctions, which is making efforts to restore the country's rights as a national duty. Sanctions arise from the international behavior and phenomena, and they disturb the future security and stability of the world. For a country which imposes sanctions, international law or human rights are not important.
Iran has been under U.S. sanctions for the past 4 decades. The sanctions intensified following the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from a 2015 nuclear deal in May 2018, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Iranian authorities have repeatedly blamed the U.S. sanctions for shortage of medicines that treat special diseases like cancer. Health officials have warned that the harm caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran's access to pharmaceutical supplies may even get worse in the future. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed the readiness of the Lebanese resistance to face any possible Israeli aggression against Lebanon. He said any Israeli act of aggression would trigger an advanced version of the 2006 war, when the Tel Aviv regime suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of Hezbollah.
The Zionist enemy continues to threaten us with military aggression. We respond by means of steadfastness, resistance, and retaliatory strikes. We hereby declare that if they commit a foolish act and attack our territories, there would then be a new version of the July 2006 war.
He warned Israelis that Hezbollah would fight in an even more sophisticated manner in any future confrontation, stressing that the outcome will eventually be a victory for the resistance fighters. Sheikh Qasem was speaking at the 6th International Conference for the Union of Resistance Scholars in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Representatives of the Palestinian resistance factions also stressed that the United States' all-out support for the Israeli warmongering policies has given a cover to the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities as its genocidal Gaza war has marked 150 days. Hamas official Osama Hamdan stressed that Muslim nations are duty-bound to foil U.S.-Israeli plots against war-torn Gaza.
It is the duty of Arabs and Muslims worldwide to take the initiative and foil Israel's conspiracy of starvation. The countries neighboring the Gaza Strip must not stand idly by and should take a concrete measure, especially for Gazans in the north.
Scholars and thinkers from diverse Muslim countries have come together to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message that, look, you be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling. They are saying they're going to fight to the end. And therefore, they say, if you want to help, it's your responsibility. It's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its fifth month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah, as a political component, has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore, the American measures putting pressure on the local economy, we believe, will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world, and through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen.
It was the second occasion on which Pakistani lawmakers elected Shehbaz Sharif as the new premier of the country. Shehbaz Sharif assumed office as Pakistan's prime minister for the first time in April 2022, following the dramatic ouster of Pakistan's jailed ex-prime minister Imran Khan from power through a parliamentary no-confidence vote. Sharif, the younger brother of Pakistan's three-time Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, secured 201 votes in the lower house of the parliament. He emerged victorious over his rival Omar Ayub Khan of the PTI party, led by jailed ex-PM Khan, who managed to secure 92 votes. A candidate needs a simple majority of votes in the 336-member house to win the post.
From the deepest core of my heart, I thank those who with their votes and love elected me as the leader of this house. People have been given a split mandate in the general elections, and those having reservations about election results need to approach the appropriate forums. We have no personal egos, and the other side also needs to follow the suit for the sake of Pakistan.
The election of the new Pakistani premier was marred by nationwide protests by the supporters of imprisoned Imran Khan against alleged rigging in the recently held elections. Several party workers who were staging protest demonstrations against results manipulation in the recently held elections were arrested.
I am here to request Election Commission of Pakistan, the Judiciary of Pakistan and Chief Secretary of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to take strict action against the ROs, the DROs, who not only violated the Election Act and election rules and oath of their offices, but also violated Constitution of Pakistan, in which preamble states that the people of Pakistan will decide the fate of their representatives through ballot.
The newly elected Premier Sharif, who is expected to take the oath of the office on Monday, has been congratulated by several neighboring countries, including China, Iran, and Turkey.
As Shehbaz Sharif assumes the role of Prime Minister for a second time, he is pitted against a multitude of challenges. These include fragile economic and political conditions. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean doctors rallied Sunday, threatening to go on strike following the government's decision to increase the quota for incoming medical students from about 3,000 to 5,000. Doctors say the measures will not necessarily alleviate the shortage of physicians in less desirable specialties and locations.
In essential medical care, the conditions are relatively poor and there are legal burdens such as frequent criminal lawsuits compared to non-essential medical care. It cannot be said with certainty that the increased number of doctors will flow into essential medical care and rural medical care.
Triggered by the government plan, 9,000 resident doctors in training out of 13,000 across the country walked out on February 20th. Patients have been scrambling for care with hospitals understaffed.
The government wants to win the general election by winning votes from the people, and that is why it is ultimately implementing populist policies without making a scientific or rational decision and without any preparation.
Polls suggest the South Korean public largely supports the government, and President Yoon Suk-yeol has seen his approval ratings increase since the standoff with doctors emerged. The government has filed criminal complaints against the leaders of the Korea Medical Association who organized this rally. Doctors who failed to comply with the back-to-work order face the suspension of their licenses, fines, and potential jail sentences. Both sides appear to be digging in. Medical schools don't have the capacity to accommodate so many new students, say some administrators. National Assembly elections are scheduled for April 10th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight.
The British government has quietly signed a contract targeting 20% cuts to the number of new education plans for children with special educational needs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Hundreds of children with special educational needs have been waiting for a year or longer to access support, as local authorities across England buckle under the strain of demands placed on them. Freedom of Information requests found that in some local authorities, children and young people have been waiting more than 2 years to be issued with an education, health and care plan that details the support they require. The Freedom of Information results suggest that across England, more than 20,000 cases were waiting longer than the 20-week limit, and as many as 3,000 for a year or more. Local council leaders say that requests for education, health and care plans have surged in recent years while funding to meet the children's needs has not kept pace. Since 2019, the number of plans issued has risen by 72%, so that in 2023, more than 500,000 children and young people had education, health and care plans. But dedicated funding from central government for special education needs and disabilities has only risen by 42%. Alex Dale, the cabinet member for education at Derbyshire County Council, said, "It's clearly a massive issue and no local authority wants to be in a position where it is going over the statutory time frame or making families wait any longer than they should." Alex Dale, who also chairs the F40 group of local authorities campaigning for fairer education funding, said one of the main reasons behind the delays was the sheer increase in demand. He said, "In my local authority, we've calculated that the number of education, health and care plans we have on our books, if you like, has doubled in the past 7 years, and that's pretty much replicated across the country." Derbyshire is investing a further £1 million to improve its processing of education, health and care plans. But Alex Dale says that £1 million has got to come from the council's own resources, which are very much under pressure anyway. And there's a huge competing demands. It's a real challenge. No one wants to be in a position that we're in at the moment. But I think it's an inevitable consequence of that rise in demand. Even after education, health and care plans have been issued, parents who spoke to the Guardian newspaper described a nightmarish system of appeals and tribunals to obtain support, including a case in York of identical twins whose parents were offered only one place in a special school. Sean Eleven, the chief executive of the Twins Trust charity, said, "Unfortunately, this case is common and similar to others that we've seen. Families with multiples already face significant economic, social and health disadvantage. Issues with school admissions just cause extra stress and extra anxiety for both the parents and the children." Another case involving twins in Guildford, Surrey, highlights the difficulties that parents are facing. David and Louise May have twin sons, one without special needs who is in a mainstream secondary school preparing to take his GCSEs. But his twin brother Jack, diagnosed with autism and ADHD, has been out of full-time education since summer of 2022, despite having an education, health and care plan through Surrey Council. Jack was placed in a mainstream school in Year 7, but his struggles made it unsustainable. An initial rejection of a special school place was overturned after Jack's parents appealed. This was followed by the offer of a special school place for children with severe disabilities that was unsuitable. Jack's parents then found him a place at a private school, which the school abruptly ended after the COVID crisis, saying it could not meet his needs. Now they're waiting for the local authority to redraw Jack's education, health and care plan, and are hoping that a place in an appropriate school can be found while Jack receives 12 hours a week of home tuition funded by the local council. The couple have had a continuing struggle with Surrey Council over Jack's education, with David May describing months and months passing without getting responses from the administration. He said, "The problem is, in my opinion, that staff are overworked, underpaid, stressed out, and they can't get enough places. And so there's a massive turnover of staff. How can they place children without enough places?" Munira Wilson, the Liberal Democrat spokesperson on education who raised Jack's case during a parliamentary debate on special needs funding, recently said, "Imagine how devastating it is for parents to see one child thrive while its twin suffers." A spokesperson for the Department of Education claimed the government was committed to improving support. The spokesperson said, "High needs funding for children and young people with complex needs will be increasing to a total of over £10.5 billion in 2024-2025, an increase of over 60% since 2019-2020. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. The British government has quietly signed a contract targeting 20% cuts to the number of new education plans for children with special educational needs and disabilities to bring down costs. Then Junior Education Minister Claire Coutinho, recently promoted to the Cabinet as Energy Secretary, subsequently told MPs that no targets were in place. The cuts target has emerged as councils across England grapple with huge financial deficits on SEND budgets, caused by a combination of rising demand and long-standing underfunding. Part of the government's response has been the launch of the Delivering Better Value in SEND programme, which supports 55 councils to bring down their large SEND budget deficits through measures such as early intervention and teaching children with special needs in mainstream schools. In June of 2022, the Department for Education signed a £19.5 million contract with consultancy firm Newton Europe to design and develop the Delivering Better Value in SEND programme. The deliverable section of the contract states that it is the intention of the signatories that the 55 councils' budget management plans implemented under the DBV programme will help achieve impacts including reduced cost pressure as a result of reduced growth in the number of education, health and care plans, targeting at least a 20% reduction in new education, health and care plans issued. The contract states that the impacts will be measured by monitoring education, health, care plans growth rates and the state of councils' education budgets.
your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, is there any horror that the Palestinians in Gaza have not gone through since October? These people have been starved, denied water, electricity, gas, and at times communications. They've been bombed by planes, tanks, drones, snipers, and they have been kidnapped, raped, tortured, and imprisoned. And on Thursday, even they were bombed while in line trying to get flour for their starving families in what is being called the Flour Massacre. It's just another massacre in a long line of so many others in Gaza. All of this while there's still talk of a ceasefire, but no action of really implementing one. How many more Palestinians must be killed before the powers that be say enough? I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Montreal, author and political activist Yves Engler. And out of Tehran, Ali Salam, editor-in-chief Basira Press.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. I'll start this off in Montreal. And Yves, on Thursday, the Flour Massacre took place where at least 112 more Palestinians were killed and over 750 injured. Officials of the Israeli regime have been very smug with their explanations and basically say the hungry masses, Palestinians, brought this on themselves due to attacking the humanitarian trucks. I mean, your thoughts on all of this and seeing that scene, what went through your mind?
They keep doing things that are even worse than one would imagine they could do. The bar just keeps going lower and lower. The Israeli propaganda response, the denying it, and then some of their spokespeople saying, oh yeah, we did kill some people, but they deserved it because they threatened us. And then seeing all these apologists for Israel's genocide on social media just denying it all happened, it's hard to wrap one's head around, there's complicity shared around all of the self-described democracies and human rights countries of the West are enabling this, you know, starving people trying to get some food being mowed down by a occupying power that has been put them under siege for two decades, that, you know, drove them from their homes 75 years ago and has been regularly terrorizing Palestinians of Gaza.
Well, Ali, do you think the bottom line is that to the Western powers that be, Palestinians and the people of this region are basically seen as less than?
It's in their own words, as we heard from various statements, the words such as human animals, and some of them said that, no, we shouldn't use the term human animals because that's even an insult to animals themselves. So what is going on and what you and our guests have described is 100% deliberate. It's not accidental. And then when they lie about it, the lies are also deliberate. Their lies have been torn apart now. Even the one who concocted the lies of the mass rape story has had to essentially quietly admit that it was a totally uncredible story. But that gets buried and that doesn't get shown in the front pages. But people are losing their accounts on social media for telling these truths. People are called, like, I don't even know, what are they calling, rape deniers or all these other types of terms. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said that if we don't expose the truth about these lies and that there's no evidence for their claims, that it all comes from these dubious IDF sources, we can see the dead Palestinian children every single day. If there was really one single dead or beheaded Palestinian child that wasn't generated by some AI image generator, as was in one case on social media, they would have no shame in plastering it around the world and making it poster that they would show on all the screens in Times Square, and they would shine on the, I don't know, all the famous buildings in Europe with high-powered projectors. They would shove it in our face, but they can't. They only have hearsay. But all these people are dying and being intentionally murdered and mowed down based on these lies, as an excuse to cover up their pre-planned, premeditated mass slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, Eves, can you think of any part of the Western world that, if more than 30,000 civilians would have been killed, that nothing would have still been done by now to stop this murder?
No, I mean, there are lots of crimes in the imperial history. You look at what the U.S. did in Iraq in 2003. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands were killed as a result. So
Western world, because I know, unfortunately, as was just talked about, in this part of the world, people seem to be disposable. But in the West, if something like this had happened, would they have allowed this to continue?
Well, we don't need to. I mean, we can just look at what they're doing with regards to Ukraine right now, where, you know, the UN says over 2 years, a bit over 10,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed. Israel did that in, you know, probably the first 30 or 40 days of this onslaught on Gaza. The Canadian government's reaction, U.S. government, is to pump in huge amounts of weapons, all kinds of sanctions on Russia, on and on and on. There is no doubt our political culture in Canada specifically, but North America, the NATO countries, treats Palestinians as to frame it as lesser is to use too light of language. I mean, the you look at a situation like the Israeli quote unquote hostages that are in Gaza. There's all this focus still put on this question, but this is like, this is completely irrelevant if you look at this issue from a big picture humanist perspective. I mean, there's thousands of Palestinian children who have lost limbs. And you don't even, that issue is just never even like mentioned in our media, but we'll hear endlessly about some Israeli soldiers that are still being, held so that all the thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners, that they can maybe get the release of these thousands and thousands of Palestinians who've been kidnapped by Israel. All through our political culture. In this country, there's more focus on the feelings of some Jewish students at a university campus vis-a-vis a protest against the genocide than there is coverage of 30,000 Palestinians killed. That's more important than some feelings of somebody. So all throughout the political culture, the racism is absolutely just oozing. And no, there's no doubt that if there was, anything in the vicinity of what Israel's done, happening to white people, to happening to our self-described allies, this would be, the outrage and the opposition would be, immediate and would put a stop to it.
Right. Well, isn't it all quite ironic when it is the West which created the Zionist entity? The West supports Zionism, and the West also supported Nazism. These ideologies were created by them, but were used as an excuse to steal Palestinian land and to commit a continuous genocide against the Palestinians.
Absolutely. The supremacist mentality is something that basically dominates their thought. They just differ on who is the chosen people. Actually, I was listening to a very powerful speech from Sheikh Imran Hussein, and he was saying that this mental, spiritual, philosophical virus of this chosenism is what drives all the oppression that exists in the world today, that drives all the misery and bad things that we see in the world today. This idea that there is a group of inferior people, and that some group of people are superior, and they have a right to basically just do as they wish upon the so-called inferior peoples of the world, because either they're lesser humans in some cases, or sometimes they go even further and say that they're not humans at all, as is we're seeing here in the case of Palestine. So this is really a satanic ideology, because the first supremacist was Lucifer, Iblis himself, as the story in the Holy Quran demonstrates. So they can't claim that they're chosen of God when they're following such an evil satanic ideology. So they can only fool so many people for so long. But I think the world is actually waking up. And the fact that they're so masked off about it, if we can see all the people in Israeli Telegram chats cheering on when they see dead babies, when they see, the other day, a man driven over by a bulldozer while he was still alive. They can't call themselves people of God when they're endorsing such wickedness and corruption on this earth.
Right. Well, Eves, the Israeli regime is not only dangerous for Palestinians, but to the whole region and world, as it has never had to abide by international law. Now, thus it bombs and assassinates at will. It is not only committing genocide in Gaza and murdering others in the West Bank, but it is invading the sovereignty of Lebanon and Syria and committing assassinations. Do you think that more countries are beginning to understand the dangers of this entity? And do you think that more countries will change their policies toward it?
Well, I think that what's happening in Latin America. Colombia announced yesterday or the day before that they were no more arms to Israel. You look at what Lula, the president of Brazil, said about the genocide. There's no doubt that that's it's growing sentiment. I saw Nicaragua brought Germany is bringing Germany to the International Court of Justice for their complicity in the genocide. So the rest of the world, aside from a handful of North American former European settler countries like Australia and some Western European countries, the vast majority of the world has been hostile to Zionism and Israel for a long time, and that's growing. I think that the people are just appalled by what they're seeing. Leaders, powerful people around the world, even appalled. I think also it's interesting to see the developments within the imperial core. If you look at what happened in Michigan in the U.S. state in the primary, you know, you had this really big support for the uncommitted. And this was a really, you know, grassroots campaign to oppose Joe Biden's genocidal policy. If you look at the election of George Galloway in Britain in the by-election a couple days ago, the people, when they have a chance to, you know, weigh in on this question, there's a lot of dissent. Here in Montreal, it's unprecedented, the level of protests across Canada. We're tomorrow's going to be 22 weekends in a row of mass demonstrations against Canada's complicity in the genocide. So the opposition, even within those countries that are the ones that are heavily responsible for Israel's crimes, is growing. Now, you know, the U.S. empire is powerful. Right, so they have a way of protecting Israel diplomatically. They have a way of making it difficult for countries like Brazil or Colombia or Nicaragua to really, you know, for that spirit of opposition to really grow. But I think that around the world, people and governments are just appalled by what Israel's doing.
Well, I mean, the majority of the population in Gaza is on the brink of starvation. The U.S. says it will start airdropping food. Why doesn't Washington just demand that the genocide end immediately? And why doesn't the U.S. demand the Zionist regime just let the aid trucks in?
This is just one big PR move to let off steam, because the international pressure and the international PR debacle that the Zionists have done has really been to their own detriment. But they're too arrogant, and they're psychopaths. Who would kill this many people and not have a few screws loose in their heads? So this is just something to buy a little bit of PR for the Zionist regime. I personally think it's a little bit odd that the United States, they actually did the airdrop already of 66 packages. I think, you know, anybody who's aware of the satanic numerology, I think that's a little bit odd for the U.S. to do after they support the genocide. This is, they're like basically stabbing the people in the back and then giving them a Band-Aid. It's incredibly hypocritical and sadistic, and it's as if they're mocking the Palestinians whom they've killed in the tens of thousands.
Well, Eves, I want you just to think about these statistics for a minute. Since October the 7th, more than 30,000 people have been killed, and even more because, of course, unfortunately, there's so many still under the rubble. At least 12,500 kids have been killed, averaging about 85, 90 kids a day being killed. Your thoughts on the type of regime that could do this to begin with?
Well, it's a regime that obviously believes in a supremacist ideology. These are Jewish supremacists, which has been what Zionism has been about for a long time. But these are real Jewish supremacist fanatics that are in charge. And alongside that is a government, a state apparatus that operates with impunity. And it has been told over and over again for decades that it can basically do whatever it wants, and it will have the backing of the powerful forces. And, you know, just a really concrete example of that, you know, when the International Criminal Court began an investigation in 2020 into Israeli officials' war crimes, the Canadian government delivered a letter to the ICC saying, do not investigate Israeli war crimes, and threatened to cut off Canadian assistance to the ICC, which was a significant part of ICC budget. That's a really concrete message to the Israeli government to do whatever it wants to Palestinians. And, you know, there's many, many, many other examples of that. And so that's the nature of it. I agree, it's unequivocally a sadistic regime. I don't think you know, there is a logic, I do think, to what they're doing here. I don't think they believe they're going to defeat Hamas or wipe Hamas out. I mean, I think there's some small element of wanting to do that, and obviously to, you know, kill Hamas fighters and resistance fighters. Israel wants to do that and has had a modest amount of success doing that. I don't think it believes it can actually just, you know, crush Hamas. But I do think it wants to drive, you know, everyone out of Gaza. That's if you care about a Jewish state, if your objective is a Jewish state, obviously the fact that there are more non-Jews in the region, that's a problem demographically for the Zionist entity. So if they could drive out hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, all of Palestinian population in Gaza, why wouldn't someone who you know is concerned about having a Jewish state and having a state based upon Jewish supremacy, why wouldn't they want to try to do that? And I think that's part of what they're trying to do. It's horrendous. It's you know, it's completely supremacist, but there is a logic to it from the perspective of this European colonial supremacist outpost that we call Israel.
Well, Ali, are you optimistic about the possibility of a ceasefire taking place before the month of Ramadan, as Egypt will host more talks?
If I remember correctly, in 2014, during that war or that slaughter, although it's a mini at the time I called it, and many other people were calling it a genocide, but it seems like a mini genocide compared to what it is today, unfortunately. The Zionists at that time had pledged to make, and it was during the time of Ramadan, I remember because it was my first time as doing Ramadan as a new Muslim. They pledged to make it the darkest Ramadan in history. So I don't think the Israelis will have any kind of humanity. I mean, they don't have any humanity anyways, but they certainly won't extend it, perhaps not even for a PR win during the holy month of Ramadan. And I don't trust the Egyptians or the Qataris enough to broker an honest ceasefire that would not let the blood of all these martyrs go to waste. So I think the ultimate guarantor of any ceasefire will be the arms of the resistance, because they are humiliating the Zionist regime. How many billions of dollars are they losing per day just in the Zionist entity alone due to the situation in northern occupied Palestine, thanks to Hezbollah, and also the areas surrounding Gaza, as well as Yemen and Iraq's strikes against the southern tip of Eilat, I believe is the name. And then just the global ramifications on the shipping routes, thanks to particularly to Yemen and Ansarullah. So I believe that the pressure from the resistance will secure